Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. On this week's show, I'm speaking to Mia Levitin, a former financier. Levitin left the corporate world behind in favour of the arts. Now a cultural and literary critic, she's written for a number of prominent publications from the FT to The Guardian. Her latest book, The Future of Seduction, is part of a series of five futures essays and details the ever-changing world of sex, dating and relationships in the digital era. Mia, thank you so much for coming on the show. Now, one of the reasons I really wanted to do this interview is that after a decade, I'm recently single and looking for advice. And I understand that for you, writing the book came out of a similar situation.
Absolutely. And I hope you're having a better time of it than I did. Because I met my ex-husband in New York in the early aughts, and it was very traditional courtship. I had never been online myself. And, you know, we met on a blind date, if you remember those, you know, didn't even know what he looked like. And then when I got divorced, it was the year that Tinder had launched in the UK. And while at first I was sort of, you know, thrilled by the possibilities that online dating and apps in particular offered, it didn't take long to realize that it had kind of fundamentally altered the way we behaved and courtship rituals. And I, you know, maintained that it was for the worse.
Well, I mean, a quote from the book, you say the dots have coalesced to form a picture of the landscape of love and lust, revealing that unless we change course, we will be, in a word, screwed.
That's right.
Because it does look pretty bleak, doesn't it? I mean, you point out that the average person in medieval times is thought to have laid eyes on fewer than 100 people in the course of a lifetime. And now, of course, the choice is infinite.
Absolutely. And I should caveat that for what we call thin markets, so people who have special needs, disabilities, LGBTQ users who have a harder time meeting people in real life, those satisfaction rates are consistently higher. And of course, that's a self-perpetuating loop. So as gay bars have been kind of killed by apps, there are fewer and fewer offline opportunities. However, if you're straight in a city, the apps offer indeed, you know, quasi-infinite choice or seemingly quasi-infinite choice because you're always getting new profiles popping up, which creates, you know, several issues cognitively, right? Because they're very cleverly designed to keep you on, to kind of hijack your attention, just as we've seen with social media and other addictive technology. And so their goal is really not for you to meet people and have meaningful interactions, even short term. Their goal is to keep you looking at your screen, always at the next person.
Yeah, I mean, it's an instant drip feed, as you say, of dopamine, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And another wonderful quote, I thought, was, while technology may not spell the end of the species, it's naive to think that wedging hard devices in the soft spaces between us is not fundamentally altering intimacy.
Well, that's kind of what inspired me to write the book because, you know, like you, when I got divorced, you know, I'm a sort of researcher by nature. And so I thought, right, okay, surely this has been written about. Maybe I just need to kind of, you know, refresh my playbook. And then, you know, as I started to look, nobody seemed to be taking it seriously. I think because it affects mostly young people and frankly, women who are seemingly most concerned by it, although of course men are suffering as well. You didn't get the same level of consideration that you'd had for how technology was affecting cognition or democracy or other kind of societal issues. And the result is that I, along with other women, started to feel that it was my fault. You know, I was too old, I was unattractive, I was doing it wrong. And, you know, my mission was really to show that it's a kind of a big cultural problem. We're dealing with a much broader societal issue than just something personal.
Mm. Let's have a look at some of those apps. So, I mean, Tinder, which is famously just for hookups, but there are others too that all work in slightly different ways and target a different demographic.
That's right. So Tinder remains by far the market leader. It's the most profitable non-gaming app, which is extraordinary. And then, you know, all of the copycats have tried to differentiate themselves one way or another. So, for example, Bumble, the woman makes the first move, kind of seemingly more feminist.
I love Bumble, I have to say.
Oh, I'm so glad. But I think, you know, what I found and what the research shows as well is that even if the woman makes the first move, then after that first contact, it kind of goes the way it had been. And that's another thing I address in the book is sort of, you know, we're in this moment, I think, of cultural shift whereby, you know, people of our generation will still expect to be pursued. And, you know, only 1% of women who consider themselves feminist reported wanting to do the pursuing. And so we're in this kind of place whereby we want to be pursued. That's how we perceive seduction, really. And yet we are trying to kind of be more egalitarian. So I think there are some issues around that as well.
I mean, you point out that swiping turns us all into teenagers making snap judgments solely on the basis of looks. And that is exactly how it works, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things that came out of my research was that we all think looks matter. So the apps will argue that it's no different from meeting eyes across a bar. However, the reality is, you know, even in a bar, there are still a lot of cues you get that aren't just two-dimensional photograph, as we've all had by matching with somebody we find attractive and then having absolutely nothing in common or no chemistry. And so one of the reasons I think the apps are inefficient is that that's pretty much all the data you have. Now, some have tried to kind of build out around it, you know, offering more of a profile, conversation starters, and trying to adjust for that. But nevertheless, you have a two-dimensional photograph, and most people will select on the basis of just the profile picture. And so what that leads to is, you know, that's all you have to go on. And so the interesting research that came out was that OkCupid had done an experiment in 2013 called Crazy Blind Date. And they sent people randomly matched, so not on the basis of sort of relative looks at all. And they found that it had no impact whatsoever on whether they had a good time. So you could match a 1 with a 10, and they still had the same level of success, so to speak, as people who were matched on looks. And so basically, as we move towards apps being the primary way we meet people, we're, you know, basing ourselves on a criterion that actually has no bearing on whether we enjoy ourselves on a date, which I find just extraordinary.
You investigated a couple of other ways of hooking up with people or starting a relationship with people. One of them was eye gazing. Tell me about that.
Oh, yes, that was one of my more fraught experiences. So there was one of the most popular New York Times Modern Love columns, and again, kind of based on my research of, well, how do you meet people, was a woman who had been on a date and asked a series of increasingly intimate questions, 36 questions, which, you know, get quite heavy towards the end of, you know, how do you think you'll die? And what's your relationship like with your mother? I don't recommend them on a first date. I've tried. And then 4 minutes of sustained eye gazing. And so on this basis, I thought I saw something in Time Out for silent speed dating, whereby there was no talking. You didn't have your sort of normal 5 minutes of chat. And you just gazed at the other people for, I think, I can't remember, but similar. It was something like 3 or 5 minutes. And, you know, it was torturous because, again, it's not just about, you know, even in-person chemistry. You want to hear what somebody has to say. And so I found that really quite disappointing personally.
Well, the people do say, though, that after having that sustained eye contact, you form some kind of bond. But that wasn't your experience.
Well, interesting. I think you have to like the person. And that's they find this, in fact, one of the basically video dating has gone through the roof since the pandemic, understandably. But one of the things that you can't do on video is have real eye contact, right? Because you're looking at the camera and the other person is looking at the camera or themselves, but you're not really looking into somebody's eyes. And in fact, what they are able to do, although it sounds to me terribly unsexy, is find out post facto whether or not you like somebody by looking at pupil dilation, which happens automatically when you like somebody, whether it's romantic or not. And so that's one of the reasons. And heart rate going up is another way. They could hypothetically tell if you were to wire yourself up on a video date. However, that to me doesn't really seem like much progress because frankly, you know, if you don't know if you like somebody, you know, where are we?
There's another really weird thing that you describe, pheromone parties.
Oh, yes. That one I fortunately missed out on. But pheromones are fascinating because I spoke to a zoologist, actually. This is how deep I went into research. And while they have determined that it does have an effect on mate selection for, you know, hammerhead fruit bats and certain species in the animal kingdom. In fact, there's so much bacteria in our underarms, not to be gross, but it is very hard to separate it. So, you know, it took them, I think, 30 years to get to a place where they could determine it for moths. So we're a long way from knowing how it works for humans. But again, you know, even if you were able to sort of be matched on smell, like, isn't part of the whole pleasure of dating the discovery, the serendipity, the not knowing. And I think that kind of any technological advances sort of take away part of what used to be fun anyway, right? Kind of, you know, how much of our lives are really sort of unprogrammed and unscripted.
Mm. Now, of course, it's not only the rise of technology that has radically altered the way we meet and interact with each other. Another big thing to have happened recently is the whole hashtag MeToo movement. Famously, there was the French column saying, this is the end of flirting. Do you think it's affected dating in that way?
Well, interestingly, it depends who you ask. So older men and Republicans, surveyed by Pew, think that now men have a hard time approaching women. So you kind of wonder how those men were approaching women before. My take on the whole Catherine Deneuve thing is that she's conflating flirtation and harassment by, you know, you can pursue. And in fact, I learned this myself when I did a fearless flirtation course in London. When one of the exercises was to approach somebody in the street and ask for directions. So again, the goal wasn't to get somebody's number. It didn't have to be romantic and interest. It was really just to practice approaching people because that's how far we've gotten. We're so on our phones and so unused to a spontaneous encounter that we don't know how to do that anymore, which I think too is part of the problem. It's not just Me Too and that men are scared of approaching women. It's more that for young people in particular, we've all experienced this, you know, you almost kind of don't expect a phone call. You have to text to set up a phone call. And I think, you know, my fear is that we don't know how to talk to one another anymore. And again, that's not just romantic. So it's this loop. We get used to the sort of safety of a screen. And then if you do see somebody you like in a bar, you know, do you have the courage to go up and talk to them? And that's kind of where I hope after the pandemic, people kind of think twice and sort of gain some courage.
Well, of course, the pandemic is the other thing. How do we do dating in the age of corona?
Well, it's tricky. And, you know, in fact, in the Times, there were two women who just said they'd sort of been quasi-celibate all year because, you know, video dating's gone through the roof, but, you know, it has its limitations. You still need that in-person contact eventually, right? So people have found it useful as a sort of way of eliminating candidates, but it's difficult to build intimacy over video. And then, of course, you know, there's the physical element that you just can't recreate. And so I think the positives are that people are being a little bit more thoughtful, having, you know, exclusivity conversations earlier sort of by necessity because, you know, you don't want to be taking risks. But, you know, the downside is that for people who are sort of, you know, worried about fertility and stuff, you know, we really have lost a year of our lives. So I really kind of feel for younger people who are in that situation.
Mm. How many dates did you go on in pursuit of all of this information?
A lot. So I went on 111 and, you know, then I sort of hung up my cleats because I thought, listen, this is just inefficient. It's not fun. And I found myself behaving in ways that I wasn't very proud of. So, you know, one of the other big effects that texting in particular and apps have had on dating is ghosting. And, you know, when I found that I sort of wasn't responding to people in as I should be doing, then I thought, you know, this isn't good for anybody.
And did you find anyone that you wanted to be with?
You know, I met some friends. I met some interesting people. I dated out of all of those people. I dated a couple of people for a short amount of time, but not anything significant. And I kind of joke in the book that I would have been better off sitting on my stoop and talking to 111 people who walked by. And I think there is some element to that because, again, at the beginning you think, wow, this is fantastic. I can meet people kind of 15 years my junior who live in East London, and this is great. But the reality is, you know, is that something that's going to work for you? And are the sort of ancient technologies of friends and family and work, if it's done appropriately, and kind of your social circle, are those not kind of more likely to work out?
So are we just going to end up sad and old and lonely and eaten by Alsatians?
I certainly hope not. I mean, I think, you know, the good part is that I do think people are sort of, women are not hanging their happiness so much on their relationships. So, you know, that I find quite positive that people are sort of getting on with it, having very rich lives, careers, friendships. But, you know, ultimately, the quality of our happiness depends on the quality of our relationships, and that's not just romantic. I worry less about relationships, frankly, than I do about sex, because I think the other issue I talk about in the book is that just, in fact, from my own experience, I think we've actually taken a step back. So while we've had, you know, quite rapid progress on marriage equality and gender non-binaries, I think straight women are actually worse off than we were a generation ago sexually, primarily because of the influence of porn.
And in fact, you say heterosexual women have fewer orgasms than any other demographic.
Yeah, isn't that remarkable? So, and that is very reliant on how often that hookup is. So in first-time encounters, women are a third as likely to climax. In sort of ongoing encounters, you know, friends with benefits and the like, about half as likely. And then that gap narrows to 69% as likely in ongoing long-term relationships where there's more of an incentive. And I've done a lot of thinking and research on consent, and most experts think that this has to do with the ubiquity of porn and that particular script on the tube sites. Of course, you have all the porn under the sun, but what most people are watching is focused on male pleasure, where female pleasure is just performative. And so even very well-meaning young men who are sort of nice guys, so to speak, they're just conditioned to think that their pleasure is what matters. And that's something that I think we don't talk enough about.
Mira, I want you to leave me with something hopeful, something I should be doing or signing up to, or anything really that won't make me feel quite so bleak about the future of dating.
No, I think that, like so many parts of our lives, the pandemic has given us a chance to think things through. And I do think what I find very positive is there's a growing awareness of the downsides of smartphones in general, right? So you have, you know, documentaries like The Social Dilemma. And I think while that information has been around for a few years now, it's sort of entering into the public consciousness. And so what I hope is that the smartphone eventually, either through legislation or just social norms changing, I mean, it's been called the cigarette of the century. And you'll remember that, you know, the cigarettes, when we were young, I lived in Paris, people would smoke throughout the meal. I mean, chain smoke through the meal. And overnight that changed. So I don't think it's impossible to imagine a future, a near future, where all of a sudden we're just not on our phones anymore. And I think that too, if you think about it, it's very individualistic, the phone. So, you know, you look at Google Maps and it puts you in the center of the universe, and then your environment adjusts itself around you. And so, you know, I'd like to go back, you know, without seeming old-fashioned, to where we are players in a bigger world, right? And that's with our kind of our landscape and other human beings. And so, yeah, I'm hopeful actually that people will just realize that we're wasting our time and either put down the phone entirely or sort of learn to use it in a more productive manner.
So, Mia, when this is all over, will you be my wingwoman? Shall we go out on some double dates?
Yes, I would love to.
Thank you so much for talking to us. The book is called The Future of Seduction, and it is by Mia Levitin. It's published by Unbound. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.